Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Egypt is an ancient civilization with a newborn democracy. So, after revolutionaries toppled dictator Hosni Mubarak, growing pains were expected. The top generals have been ruling the country for 6 decades, and they weren't about to give up power without a fight. They dissolved the legislature last month after a court order, and they seized all lawmaking and executive authority. On the show today, to give us some perspective on what's happening in Egypt, is Time Magazine's correspondent in Cairo, Abigail Hausloner. She's joining us by telephone from Egypt's capital to give us behind-the-scenes view of the political confrontations that escalated this week. Abigail, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you. How are you?
Oh, doing well. How's the weather there in Cairo?
It is very hot here today.
Yeah.
It's stifling. It's almost Ramadan, so soon people will start fasting for a month as well.
Okay. So Egyptians recently elected a parliament dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and about 20 days ago they elected a conservative Islamist as their first freely elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Abigail, were people surprised that Morsi challenged the military by reinstalling parliament a week into his presidency?
I think certainly a lot of people were surprised that Morsi dared to challenge a military decree and a Supreme Court ruling to dissolve the parliament. But at the same time, a lot of analysts have been saying that Morsi has very little choice. He's in a unique situation as the first elected leader of Egypt, and he's facing off against a military that is still largely in control. It's a situation that Egypt has never before experienced, after decades of dictatorship. And everyone is sort of waiting to see how much the military will allow a transition to civilian rule. And Morsi has an obligation to his constituents to really push that transition along and stand up to the military. At the same time, he's a pragmatist, and the Muslim Brotherhood, which he represents, has always been pragmatic. And they know that causing a real confrontation with the military, especially a violent one, would not be particularly helpful to their interests.
Yeah, it seems like the leaders in this post-revolutionary Egypt are making up this particular form of democracy as they go along. Do you get that kind of a seat-of-the-pants feeling sometimes?
Well, Egypt has never experienced democracy before. Mubarak ran this country with an iron fist for 30 years. There were elections under Mubarak, but they were always a sham. They were always rigged in favor of his National Democratic Party. And the Muslim Brotherhood was allowed to compete, but, everything was always rigged. And Mubarak was part of a long line of military rulers. So this is a new experience. And Egyptians had the very first opportunity to elect a president with Morsi. And sure, it's only natural that they're figuring out how to have a democracy and how to repair, a broken country, essentially, in many ways, from here on out.
Right. I love the questions that are raised in the headlines of your articles on the Time Magazine website. It's for our viewers and listeners, it's world.time.com / contributor, and then you can look up Abigail's name and see all the articles she's written about what's happening in Egypt. For instance, the last story I have here is Egypt's President Morsi really challenging the ruling junta? How do Egypt's ruling generals deal with human rights? Islamist Morsi wins Egyptian presidency, but will the military cede any power? So it must be With all this opacity in Egypt, it must be difficult to report what's really going on.
Right. Well, it is a difficult story. This government has been very closed off to the news media for a long time, and to its public for a long time. There's never been a real culture of transparency in government here. So it's a difficult story to report. As those headlines suggest, we interview a lot of people who are speculating, essentially. You know, the military does not grant interviews very often, very rarely, in fact. And the Muslim Brotherhood, it's even the Brotherhood is, opaque to a certain extent, in that it's still unclear to the public who exactly is making what decisions and how much Morsi is really running the show, or how much he's depending on advice from this organization. So there is a lot of speculation, a lot of real digging that goes into reporting in Egypt.
Right. I imagine you make a ton of phone calls and use a lot of analysts. How do you pick your analysts? How do you try to find people who can kind of guess what's going on, educated guess, or actually maybe. Do you also use some off-the-record comments for people who are involved but don't want to speak publicly?
Sure. Off-the-record is always very useful in situations like Egypt, where you have where people in the government especially are not authorized to talk to the press but might know quite a bit about what's going on. So in those circumstances, when we're able to offer them anonymity, then they feel comfortable telling us, this is what the military said in this closed meeting the other day, and this is what Tantawi did, and so on. We now, you may have seen, our July 9th cover of Time magazine was all about the military, the Egyptian military.
Right.
And we hadn't actually attempted that kind of huge story before because the military is just so difficult to get to. But through a lot of anonymous sources, through sort of a lot of off-record meetings with people who were very close to the generals, and through a number of on-record meetings with both, lobbyists in Washington who have worked with them, and U.S. military generals who have forged close relationships with them, people here in Egypt who know them, we were able to put together, with a lot of work, obviously, a picture of what these, very sort of obscured personalities are like, and what exactly their motives are, and how exactly they're running the country, how the military is run.
Yeah. One thing I saw that the photo of, I think the photo you guys used on that story about the military was of Morsi appearing alongside the head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces at a ceremony, and they seemed to be kind of jovial and calm. So if tensions are really so high, why did Morsi appear in that setting?
Well, right. There have been, I'm not sure, you may be referring not to the magazine, but to the picture that it ran online. There have been a number of pictures that have come out, since Morsi's inauguration.
Right.
That show him next to his military partners, or, in his, this very sort of awkward political partnership that he's now in. And a lot of these pictures do seem to portray a comfortable relationship. Now, we can assume to some extent that they are working together, certainly. They are holding meetings, certainly. But, we can also guess that there's quite a bit of tension. Morsi, obviously, this is not an ideal situation for him. The Brotherhood and Morsi, as an elected leader, do not want to share power with an unelected military regime.
Right.
And the military, likewise, has always been very suspicious of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they don't really want to relinquish full power at this point. That is not in their best interest.
Right.
So there is tension, but at the same time, there are certainly indications that there are sort of backroom deals going on.
Yeah, and publicly, Morsi said he respects the generals, but he said the role is kind of simple and straightforward. In his words, to protect the boundaries and security of the country. That's about it. So do you think that's the direction that he'll be able to pull the country, or Do you think that there's going to have to be some sort of a conflict?
Well, those words from Morsi, and I mean, the way we can interpret a lot of the kind of things he said about the military lately are, you know, careful posturing, careful lip service on his part. Does Morsi, you know, really have a comfortable, respectful relationship with the generals? Probably not. He's the elected leader, and the generals, as I said, are still holding on to quite a bit of power. I don't think Morsi or the Brotherhood view the military as the ideal partners or particularly democratic, but they also realize that these are the people they have to work with. They don't have a whole lot of choice in the matter, and so both sides, both the military on one side and Morsi and the Brotherhood on the other side, are doing, I think, the best they can right now to try to get as much leverage out of the situation as they can, and that's where you have this struggle that manifests in some ways publicly, like when Morsi tried to convene Parliament, and then also, you know, behind closed doors, surely in these meetings.
Let's talk about some of the major challenges that Morsi faces in the coming months.
Okay.
Particularly, you know, there's the economy, there's the and a lot of other issues. What would you say the major challenges are?
That's right. Well, to start, you know, let's keep in mind that Morsi has just inherited the leadership or the partial leadership of a country that is in deep trouble. Now, Egypt, in the 18 months since the uprising that took down Hosni Mubarak, Egypt's economy has really plummeted. It's struggling. A lot of people are much of the economy is dependent on tourism, and tourism has all but dried up in the past 18 months. Tourists, you know, aren't particularly interested in coming to Egypt because they fear instability. So, you know, Egypt is going through a tough time, and security has also gotten a lot worse. You know, there hasn't been a really, really functional government in the past 18 months. The police force played a huge role as sort of the villain in the uprising, and there was a big backlash against them. So there's still a lot of tension between the public and the police. There isn't a whole lot of security on the streets, and the economy is terrible. And then, you know, in addition to that, let's talk about this country that Mubarak built mm-hmm. over decades. On the surface, for a long time, people talked about Egypt's GDP doing quite well, about the economy on the surface growing and looking good on an international level. But domestically, Mubarak's regime was extremely corrupt and extremely neglectful of the population. The majority of Egyptians live in poverty. 40% live actually below the poverty line. That means they live on less than $2 a day. That's extreme poverty.
That's incredible.
And a lot of Egyptians still, in 2012, do not have access to drinking water. They don't have access to sewage. They don't have decent roads, ways to get their crops to market. They have to pay bribes if they want to start a business. You know, we're talking about Egypt being really underdeveloped in a lot of ways and for a lot of people in the population. And so those are huge problems for any president to confront. And
right.
So for a president who's also under this huge amount of pressure because he's the first elected president to confront these challenges, they seem reasonably unsurmountable. Morsi will have a very difficult time, I think, showing people that he's doing a good job. He has such huge obstacles to overcome, and he has a population that is anxious to see what his performance looks like. They're very anxious to see Egypt get back on his feet, and they're waiting to see how he can affect the situation.
It's, you know, tourism is a big part of the economy there, and I heard a report that one major hotel only had 7% occupancy. So there is a perception that Egypt is unstable and unsafe. In your day-to-day life there, do you feel that it's unsafe in any way?
You know, Egypt, I think it has mostly gotten, you know, unsafe for Egyptians in certain circumstances. You know, Egyptians feel like they don't have a police force that looks out for them. But, you know, if thinking about the kinds of tourist resorts and sites that, you know, Americans would come and visit if they were on vacation in Egypt, no, the situation is still very safe. You know, the pyramids actually are, you know, safe and empty. So it's a great time to visit Egypt if you're a tourist. the beaches are empty and quite beautiful. So realistically, for tourists, there isn't a whole lot to worry about, but certainly perception in the U.S. and Europe comes from the news, which is focused, obviously, on politics. You know, we don't talk about, well, the fact that the beaches are still quite nice. That's not news. We talk about, the fact that there are clashes in Tahrir Square, or that there is a political power struggle going on, or that there's no parliament. You know, these are all good reasons to worry investors, but they end up worrying tourists as well.
Now, there also seems to be misconceptions about Islamists and about this struggle boiling down to secularists versus Islamists. After all, Morsi said in his first speech as president that he would work to include everyone in his administration, and that he would protect Christians. So can you speak on that point about the misconceptions?
Right. Well, I mean, first, let's note that those lines to Christians, to women, to different sections of Egyptian society, it is very important for Morsi's credibility and to try to shore up popularity. It's important that he addresses these groups in society. And that's because, in large part, he doesn't have an overwhelming majority of Egyptians supporting him. In fact, you know, of the Egyptians who voted, Morsi won by a slim margin.
It was like 51%, right?
Opponent. Right, exactly. And so that means that, roughly half the Egyptians who voted in this election voted against Morsi. And then, we have to consider all these people who didn't vote. So there are a lot of people out there who are very skeptical of him and who he has to reassure. And then you also have Egypt's backers, like the United States and other important allies in Europe, who are, I think, apprehensive about what it means to have an Islamist in power, how that's going to affect women, how it's going to affect Christians, and so on. Now, that said, the Muslim Brotherhood traditionally has made statements in the past, including Morsi, about the presidency and political powers. They said that a Christian or a woman cannot be president, should not be president. That's obviously offended a lot of people. But at the same time, the Brotherhood is not a violent organization, and they would be described probably as moderate, as far as a lot of Egyptians see them. You know, Egypt is a very conservative country, and the politics and even sort of religious aspects that the Brotherhood preaches are not an extreme in Egyptian society. They're pretty middle of the road, and which is part of why they're popular. And the Brotherhood is not interested, especially at this point, in isolating any groups like Christians or women. And they are pro-democracy. I mean, that seems to have been proven over the years that they have actively lobbied democratic reforms and tried to participate in parliament, even though it was a sham. So we have no reason to believe it at this point in time that they're going to be, any more opposed to democracy and Egyptians having the right to choose, their positions on their own affairs than the military, certainly.
Now, I wanted to talk a bit about Libya. You were among the first journalists to enter Libya after the mass uprise began there last year, and your recent article talked about how Egypt's democratic transition compared and contrasted with Libya's. Tell us about what's happening in Libya compared with Egypt politically.
Right. Well, I've been following both countries the past 18 months. I've been very lucky to sort of witness these two separate experiences of the so-called Arab Spring. They are two very different revolutions with so far very different outcomes. Libya, to start with, was in many ways a wealthier country than Egypt. It has a much smaller population. There are only 6 million people spread across a vast desert country in North Africa to Egypt's west. And what happened in Libya, as opposed to Egypt, is they had an uprising that very quickly transformed into an armed rebellion and civil war. Mm-hmm. When I say civil war, I mean full-on warfare, right? On front lines, battles fought between armed rebels for months against Gaddafi's forces and loyalists. And the rebels, of course, were assisted by NATO. Now, that was a, you know, that uprising, that means Libya suffered quite a lot more. I mean, the oil industry was devastated. The economy shut down for months. A lot of people lost their lives or had their homes destroyed by shelling. And so Libya, you know, has a full country to rebuild in many ways. But what's interesting is that the Libyan revolution really overthrew a regime. Not only did the rebels capture and kill Muammar Gaddafi, their dictator, 42 years, last October, but they really overthrew his regime. They chased out members of his family and cronies. They captured others, killed others. It was really what you could call, for better or worse, a full-scale revolution. And so that has had, you know, its positives and negative aspects.
And then in Egypt, most of the bureaucracy is still in place, right, in the administration?
That's right. I mean, Egypt, what you had was an 18-day popular uprising. There was violence, but, thousands of people have died in this sort of 18 months of political transition. But that said, compared to Libya, it was largely peaceful. And after 18 days of protest, Mubarak agreed to step down. Now, when Gaddafi never agreed to step down, Gaddafi was killed. Mubarak agreed to step down, and he essentially handed power to the very same generals that he had appointed. So the military that had always been in place and had always backed up Mubarak's regime essentially stepped in when Mubarak stepped down. And so the regime itself, and you hear a lot of Egyptian activists complain about this, the regime itself was never really replaced.
Right.
And so that has, you know, meant that, sure, there's been less structural damage, less lives lost in Egypt compared to Libya, but it means that Egyptian activists, people who are really crusading for change, have had a much deeper struggle over the past, over the past 18 months, trying to not only see a new leader elected, you know, but also change an entire system that, as you said, it's still largely in place.
So imagine that Tahrir Square is going to be a continuing flashpoint for protesters. But before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. Abigail, let's talk about Tahrir Square. I mean, you've been there for some pretty exciting, but also probably very fearful times. Tell us about what sticks out in your mind about your experiences covering the activities at Tahrir Square.
Well, Tahrir Square, what's interesting about it, for those of us who have been in Egypt, you know, since before the uprising, back when we really described this place as a politically stagnated country, you know, Tahrir used to just be a traffic circle. You know, it's the main traffic circle in downtown Cairo. It's very busy, congested. It has some grassy medians in the middle of it that Egyptians used to go and sit on, you know, to picnic in the evening because they're one of the few grassy places in Cairo. And, you know, in early 2011, it became this space of protest. It's now synonymous with protest and revolution, you know, around the world. Everyone knows Tahrir Square. And obviously that was the main square that Egyptians occupied during the 18-day uprising that ousted Mubarak. But also, you know, as you noted, on many occasions since, that is the go-to place for protest. So, you know, Tahrir Square has been fascinating to watch for the past few years. You know, I remember covering the uprising there, going to Tahrir every single day, and witnessing something that I'd never seen before in Egypt. I'm not just talking about a mass protest, but this unusual sort of unity There were, back in those days, Muslims, Christians, liberals, wealthy people, poor people, Islamists, Salafis, those are extreme Islamists. All these people actually camped out together in tents and talking and sharing food, literally sharing food and sharing water and helping each other. That was a really unique experience for Egypt, where people were able to unite over a common cause, and that was seeing Mubarak step down, getting rid of Mubarak. Everyone seemed to agree on that. And it was something interesting. It's now something that a lot of Egyptians look back on with quite a bit of nostalgia, because in the days, in the months since, Egypt has been characterized, or the political scene has been characterized by a lot of divisions and infighting. That was sort of the one time in the past 2 years that all these Egyptians have been able to agree. And since then, people are really trying to figure out political parties. They're figuring out how to be unified activists over other causes that are sort of less popular than ousting a dictator.
Right.
And that's something interesting to watch in Tahrir. You now have all sorts of different groups making use of Tahrir, but very rarely are they organized in the same sort of numbers that we saw in those early days in 2011.
Now, we have about 30 seconds left, so I just want to get a quick comment from you about whether you think that it's going to take another round of serious protests to get the military to give up some of its power.
That may be. The military is holding on tightly.
Right.
So a lot of people are predicting that, what would it take for the military to relinquish power? Well, it may take another revolution.
Okay.
Or,
I'm sorry, Abigail, I gotta cut us off. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Gina Cook was our lead producer. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist, where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Regina Wong. Today's news comes from the BBC and the International Press Institute. IPI reported that 2012 has claimed the lives of more journalists than any other year since 1998. By June of this year, 72 journalists have died because of their work. This number includes 20 reporters and citizen journalists who died covering conflicts in Syria. The BBC described the record number of deaths as an unprecedented global threat to impartial and independent news, and called for the protection of the rights of journalists. In Ethiopia late last month, blogger and journalist Eskinder Nega was convicted of terrorism charges. International free press organizations condemned the conviction as a violation of press freedom. Nega might face life in prison for criticizing the government. He is the fifth journalist in Ethiopia who was jailed for terrorism-related charges in the past 6 months. He received a prestigious writing award in April for his courage. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week. I'm Regina Wong. See you next week.